First, let me speak a little bit about Pirsumei Nisa, about the idea of publicizing the miracle of Hanukkah, what that means. The start with a Gemara that says the following. It says that near Hanukkah, Shehinicha Lamala Mi Esrim Amma Psula. Near Hanukkah that was put higher than 20 amos, approximately between 30 and 40 feet from ground level, is not kosher. And the reason is that lo sholta bo'ena, person really can't see the candle that high up. You can see it, but he doesn't, it's not within his line of vision that he sees it all the time. And therefore, don't fulfill the mitzvah like that, because that's not called publicizing the miracle. Right after that, the Gemara quotes the same person who said this halacha in another thing. And the Gemara quotes the following. The habor reik ein bo mayim, mayim ein bo aval nechoshim v'akrovim yesh bo. Last week's sedra, it says they threw Yosef into a pit which had no water. And the way the Torah says it, the Torah says the pit was empty, there was no water in it. So the Gemara says, obviously, if it was empty, there wasn't any water in it. So the intention is it was empty from water, but there were other things in it. There were snakes and scorpions in the pit. And that's two Gemaras that seem to have nothing to do with each other except the fact that the same person said both of them. And that's not enough for them to be mentioned just one next to the other. There has to be a better reason why the Gemara mentioned both of these things and in such proximity. So there are hundreds of explanations, Hanukkah explanations, of what these two things have to do together. Many of them center around the fact that they didn't see the snakes and scorpions because the pit was too deep, which is similar to not being able to see something that's very high. Okay, I want to tell you a different idea. Why these two things were said one next to the other. First, let's discuss miracles. Why do we publicize miracles? Okay. One would say because it shows how God controls the world and how God can do things that are supernatural. But if that's the reason, it'd be better to hide the miracle than to publicize it. Because think about it for a second. What are we saying? You know what God can do? He can make oil burn 7 days longer than normal. That is an honor to God or a disgrace to God? Seems to me it would be a disgrace, because God can make oil, right? He doesn't just able to make it burn longer. He can make the oil altogether. Beyond that, the Gemara says that to Rabbi Hanina Mendoza, a bigger miracle happened. His daughter once lit Shabbos candles with vinegar instead of oil by mistake. And when she realized the mistake, it was already Shabbos. And there was a little bit of oil left in the vinegar, so it probably burned. And she went to her father and she said that we're not going to have any light for Shabbos because I lit the candles with vinegar instead of oil. He said, what's the problem? The same God that said that oil can burn can say that vinegar can burn. It's not beyond God's control. And Rabbi Hanina Mendoza was someone who miracles happen to all the time. And therefore, that's what happened. It lit not only for Friday night, the entire Shabbos, and they made Havdalah on it, Motzei Shabbos. So God can do things. God can make vinegar burn, right? He's not limited to just making oil burn for 7 days. Beyond that, there were greater miracles in the history of the Jewish people. For the 40 years that Shimon HaTzadik was Kohen Gadol, the Ner HaMaravi, the Western candle, in the menorah, in the Beis HaMikdash, never went out. It stayed burning for 40 years. They never had to put it out. They never found it extinguished. They always lit the candles from that continuously burning candle. So that was even bigger than this miracle. So why do we publicize miracles? It's not to say that God can do tricks, because he can always do better tricks. So it's not an honor to God. It's like what the Gemara says, you're not allowed to praise God with too many adjectives. Because the more adjectives you say, the more it seems like you're exhausting God's praises, and there's nothing more to say. So you're only allowed to say those adjectives that the Torah told us we're allowed to say. More than that, right, it's not honorable, it's dishonorable to God. So then why do we publicize miracles? The answer is that God does miracles to catch our attention, for our sake, that we should learn something. Whenever he wants to teach us a lesson, so he catches our attention with something out of the ordinary, so we'll learn the lesson from what's going on. We won't just take it in our stride. The miracle is not for God to show his mastery over nature. It's to catch our attention that God's there and that he's involved even when there aren't supernatural things going on. So we have to learn something from that miracle. Now let's go back to what we started with. It says that God saved Yosef in a miraculous way from being thrown into a pit with snakes and scorpions. Right. The pit was empty of water, but there were snakes and scorpions in it. That means that Yosef had a miracle occur for him. Because the Gemara in Gittin says that if you see a man being thrown into a pit, and later on you see there are snakes and scorpions in the pit, and you don't know what happened to him, you didn't have a chance, or you happen to know that pit had snakes and scorpions in it. And then you see someone fall into that pit or be thrown into the pit. And then you couldn't go and investigate to see what happened to him. You can testify that that man is dead and his wife is allowed to remarry. Now, you don't know for sure. All you know is he fell into that pit. Maybe he got out of it. The Gemara says it's impossible. It would take an open miracle for a man to survive falling into a pit of snakes and scorpions. And even though sometimes snakes and scorpions don't attack a person, that's only when they don't fall on them. But if people fall on snakes and scorpions, they don't take to it too kindly. And they consider it an attack, and they attack back. So you can be assured, and you don't have to take into consideration that a miracle happened, that the person in that situation is dead. And you can testify that you saw this person fall into a pit of snakes and scorpions, and he's definitely dead, and his wife can remarry, even though you never saw his body.
Yeah. Wait, doesn't it say that he was thrown into the pit and then he was pulled out?
Oh, yeah. When he was
there were no snakes and scorpions?
No, there were snakes and scorpions. So why, if he was pulled out, were there no snakes and scorpions? It's just that he survived it.
He was pulled out.
So? Wait, well, so what? So he survived it. That's how he was pulled out. He shouldn't have survived it. Right? The brothers probably didn't see the snakes and scorpions. Or they did and they ignored it. But whatever, the Torah is hinting to us that there were snakes and scorpions, and that when Yosef is thrown into that pit, a miracle happened. Okay? Now, if... Yeah?
Sorry, why doesn't this apply to anyone lost at sea? For instance, when the...
Because there are possibilities of a person being shipwrecked and logs passing by that he can hang on to or whatever. And we're not sure that maybe something happened that doesn't need an open miracle.
When the Dakar sunk, they were all together. You know, the whole ship, all the crew sunk in.
Right,
together.
But there have been cases of that where it appeared that the ship sunk and there were survivors. So it's not something that we need an open miracle because they didn't know what happened to the Dakar. They had no idea. Right? It could have been captured, it could have been whatever. They didn't know. And even a boat that sinks or somebody that seemingly drowns, there have been things less than open miracles where people have survived and whatever. If, in fact, it's something that in order to survive, you have to have an open miracle, right? There's more conditions just than the person looked like he drowned in open water where you can't see the other side, where it's possible that he floated to the other side and came out. Right, then it could be that you do assume the person's dead. Whenever it's something that you need an open miracle for the person to survive, you can assume he's dead. Okay, let's go back to... In any case, so what happened over here was a tremendous miracle. Yosef was saved from a pit of snakes and scorpions. Why did the Torah only hint to it? There's a mitzvah persumei nisa, to publicize miracles. Why didn't the Torah say openly, Yosef was thrown into a pit with snakes and scorpions and a great miracle happened? Why did the Torah only hint to it? The answer is because, like we said, to publicize miracles is not to tell us that God can do tricks, but it's to tell us that God wanted to attract our attention and learn something from it. But nobody learned anything from that miracle, either because they didn't see it or because they ignored it. And therefore, they still sold Yosef into Egypt. If they had seen the miracle or taken into account, they should have realized that there's something special about this person, and we have to think twice about selling him into slavery. But since they didn't take that in consideration, either they didn't see it, or they ignored it. So nobody learned anything from this miracle. A miracle that no one learns anything from, you don't publicize. Because the whole purpose of the miracle is to learn something from it. And therefore, hold on one second. Therefore, a Hanukkah menorah that's put higher than 20 amos is possible. Why? Because you can see it, and every once in a while look up and realize that it was a miracle, but it's not in your line of vision where you can think about it. Where you can see it and think about it, what does this mean? What is this telling me? What is the intent of this miracle? Why did God do this miracle? What does he want to catch my attention to ponder? Since it's high up, every once in a while you look up and you remember there was a miracle. But it won't give you something to think about on an ongoing basis. So it has to be within your line of vision, less than 20 amos, where you'll see it on an ongoing basis and be able to think about it for it to be considered publicizing the miracle. Because otherwise, all you're doing is publicizing something supernatural and not publicizing the miracle in a way that's called Pesumei Nisa, of catching a person's attention, that he should think into what does this all this mean. And therefore, the Rambam says that when he describes the mitzvah of publicizing the miracle of Hanukkah, he says, Leharos ulegalos es hanes, to show and to uncover the miracle. To show the miracle means that we should know there was a miracle. To uncover it means to understand what it meant. What is it supposed to tell me? What are you supposed to learn from it? That is part and parcel of the mitzvah of Pirsumei Nisa. When you light those candles, it's not enough just to publicize the fact that oil burned 7 days longer. But it's, what does it mean? What was the purpose of that miracle? Okay. And now, that's what I want to speak about. Okay, now, yes. Yeah, so if the, what's it called? Since he's lighting inside, the candles are basically for the people inside the house. And from his ground, it's less than 20 amos. It's not for the people outside. Okay. What? If there are people who live opposite him, yes. But the main thing is that it's for his house, and his house floor is not 20 amos down.
What about Lubavitch with their big kind of amos?
High, they're not 20 amos, 30, 40 feet.
Opposite.
They are not, besides the fact, that is not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to light it in your home, at your door, and the mitzvah is to light it in shul. Otherwise, there is no mitzvah to light candles in the Rishus HaRabim. The rabbis never made such a takana. You can't make a bracha on that. If you make a bracha, it's a bracha levatala, right? It's a useless bracha because that's not the mitzvah, right? They, again, publicizing the miracle is part and parcel of the mitzvah. It's not just, there is no mitzvah to publicize the miracle out of the framework of the mitzvah. That doesn't mean that there's something wrong about doing it. If you make a bracha, there's something very wrong about doing it. You're making a bracha levatala. But otherwise, there's no halachic framework for lighting candles anywhere except in your home and in shul. In the shul. Okay, let's, before I get off of the that was enough. The... Okay, somebody else had a question here? Yeah.
Why do we keep saying that the brothers sold him? All they did is throw him in the pit.
No. After that, they sold him into slavery. They sold him to... Yeah, sure. No, they went, they sold him, and then other people sold him to other people until he got to Mitzrayim. But they made money on it. Okay. Okay, that's not the shiur. What? They bought shoes with it, right. Okay, obviously... Okay, now I'm going to have to say something. Not about Mechiras Yosef, but this really has to do with what we are discussing on an ongoing basis, Torah Shebaal Peh. And again, I think I quoted this last week or 2 weeks ago. It was in Torah Tidbits a few weeks ago. And that is that just as much as any mitzvah in the Torah, halacha, you can't just read the words in the Torah and expect to know what it is. You must know the oral Torah, because the written Torah without the oral Torah is a closed book, okay? And it's totally possible to distort, right? If you read the pasuk, lo sevashel gidi b'chalev imo, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, you could think that that's the only prohibition. And you're allowed to cook other animals as long as it's not its mother's milk. You can cook milk and meat together. Is that true? The rabbis, when they received this pasuk, right, when Moshe Rabbeinu heard that pasuk on Sinai, the Rabban Shem explained it to him. And he told him, I'm only telling you in its mother's milk to tell you that the animals that it applies to are mammals that have mother's milk. But I don't mean that it has to be in the mother's milk. I mean that it has to be in an animal that has mother's milk. Those are the animals that you're not allowed to cook their meat with any milk. But reading it just the way it says in the Torah, you could totally distort that mitzvah. So too, the story part of the Torah, you can't read just what it says and expect to know what it means. There is background, oral background, to every single thing in the Torah, especially the story part of the Torah. And without knowing that oral background, the Torah is a closed book. So the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, is as important in the story part of the Torah as it is in the halacha part of the Torah. So it seems like, you know, Yosef's brothers, they were jealous of him, they didn't like him, so they decided to kill him, then they decided to sell him, as if, you know, one of these Bible story books with these guys in tunics, you know, selling their brother. It's not at all what it was. These people were tzaddikim. These people God chose and didn't discard them after this. He still chose them. And he still, what's it called, put their names on the choshen of the Kohen Gadol. Right? These people were righteous people. And they were God's chosen people. How could God choose people that would sell their brother or be willing to kill him? Obviously, there was a lot more behind this than just a bunch of a story, you know, a bedtime story about a bunch of brothers who wanted to kill their brother because they were a little jealous of him. Right? There's much more to it. That's not what we're going to talk about. You can look in my Sefer, Outlooks and Insights, on last week's Sedra. I think the chapter is called An Anatomy of a Sale, and you can see a little bit of what was behind the scenes there. But that's not for now. Okay, in any case, but it does fit in. And just since it was mentioned, I didn't want to leave the impression that I agree with that. That, you know, that's what they did. They're just a bunch of brothers selling their brother. Okay. In any case, so the mitzvah Pirsumei Nisa is to understand the intent, the lesson that we're supposed to learn from that miracle. So what is that lesson? What is that lesson? It's interesting also, and this has to do with what we are discussing, that the mitzvahs of Hanukkah, the halachas of Hanukkah, all the laws are not found in the Mishnah. Okay, the laws of many Yom Tov and Shabbos and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot and even Purim has a whole Masechta, Megillah, right, that deals with the laws of Purim, Mishnayos. There is no Masechta Hanukkah, no Masechta that deals with the laws of Hanukkah. Right? Not only that, but Hanukkah is mentioned incidentally in the Mishnah in regards to other halachas. For instance, if somebody is, what's it called, running in the street when he doesn't have permission to run, and he damages somebody, he's liable. But if it's when he has a time that it's okay to run, like Erev Shabbos, right before Shabbos, people are running in the street, then it's not considered negligence to be running. Also, if somebody puts a candle outside towards the public thoroughfare and somebody comes and gets burnt by it, or money gets burnt, their property gets burnt by it, the person who put that candle towards Rishus HaRavim, towards the public thoroughfare, is liable. He shouldn't have put the candle there. But if it's Ner Hanukkah, the Mishnah says, then he's not liable, because he has a right to put it there. The Ner Hanukkah is supposed to be put by your door, adjoining the Rishus HaRavim, that opens into the Rishus HaRavim. So you have a right to put that candle there, you're not negligent. That's the only mention, or one of the only mentions, of Hanukkah in the Mishnah. Totally indirect reference. But the laws of Hanukkah, what happened with Hanukkah, is only found in the Gemara, not in the Mishnah. Okay, we didn't discuss yet what the Gemara is, but the Gemara is the discussions that went on about the Mishnah for the next 200 to 300 years, 400 years after the Mishnah was already compiled. That's where we find the laws of Hanukkah. It's in the Masechta Shabbos, few pages about the laws of Hanukkah, dealing with the fact of what kind of oils and wicks can you use on Hanukkah and compared to the oils and the wicks you can use for Shabbos candles. That's how it gets into that that discussion. In any case, and then it goes on and from one thing to another, the Gemara finds a way of speaking about the whole gamut of the halakhas of Hanukkah. But those are not mentioned in the Mishnah. Why not? Why not? So in discussing what Hanukkah is all about, we'll see why Hanukkah remained basically, even through the Mishnah, Torah Shebal Peh. It wasn't written down. It was left totally oral. Because one of the things that the Yevanim wanted to do to us is make us forget the oral Torah. So it says, L'hashkicham Torah Secha. They wanted us to forget the Torah. You can't forget the written Torah. You can burn it. You can't forget it if it's there. What it says they wanted to do is to make us forget the Torah, means they would have let us continue learning the written Torah, but the oral Torah they wanted to do away with. Why? What was so special about the oral Torah? In addition, there are five other things that they targeted. And that was Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Bris Milah, women they made special decrees against, and Jewish money. Those five things the rabbi mentions were the main decrees of the Greeks. What do they have in common? The Greeks represented a totally external view of this world. They denied any inner spiritual value, inner spiritual meaning, any inner spiritual existence in this world. The world was merely an external place, physical, material, that was it. Nothing more than that. Even their gods were basically supermen and superwomen. Physical beings just happened to be superhuman beings who had all the foibles of regular human beings. And therefore, the Greeks deified art, the body. They worshipped the body, wrestling and muscle building and everything external, might and power. Everything was the externals. That's what Greece represented. And I always like to say the name Yavan, Yud Vav Nun, represents that. Because Yavan is comprised of three letters that have no inside. They're just lines. They're totally external letters. A Yud, a Vav, and a Nun. In addition, when you quantify the physical world, when you deal with only physicality, you deal in quantity. When you deal in spirituality, you deal in quality. You measure things by quality. Physical things are measured by quantity. And there are three generic quantities: small, medium, large. That's Yavan. Small Yud, medium-sized Vav, large Nun. In addition, those three letters being totally external in three generic sizes, they also are parallel. They never meet. There is no achdus, there's no unity in a world where there is no spirituality. It's the spiritual that unifies the various different things in the world. But if there is no spirituality, then every single thing is a separate thing to itself. There is nothing that unifies anything. So here we have three parallel lines that have no inside, that come in three generic sizes, and that represents what Yavan is. In addition, the word Yavan, if you turn it backwards, spells noi, beauty. Because they basically distorted beauty completely. There is an idea of beauty. We also hold that beauty is something positive. Aesthetic beauty is an important thing. The proof is, do we look for the ugliest Hanukkah menorah? Some people, I think, do. But That's not a mitzvah, right? We look for the most beautiful Hanukkah menorah. If you would think, if we want to go against the Greeks who deified art and who made beauty into a fetish, then we should bedafka show we don't care about beauty. Now, look at the most decrepit, right, terrible-looking menorah. It's not true, because you're not allowed to use an earthenware menorah more than one time, because it gets disgusting. So you have to use a pretty. The prettier the menorah, the better it is. Hither mitzvah. Every mitzvah we have should be done in a beautiful way, in an aesthetically beautiful way. That's what hither mitzvah is. But Jewish art, throughout the centuries, perhaps not including modern times, because that's not Jewish art, that's just art by Jews. But Jewish art was never anything separate, intrinsic to itself. It was always mitzvahs that were beautified. A beautiful Seder play. Go to a museum, right, a Jewish museum, and you'll see that the Jewish art is not paintings or statues. It's mitzvahs that are beautified. Seder plates, Kiddush cups, besomim boxes. That's what Jewish art was throughout the centuries. You didn't separate the spiritual from the physical. The physical beauty was an external expression of the inner spiritual beauty. That's real beauty. That's what it says by Sarah Imenu, that Sarah was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. So first of all, who cares if Sarah Imenu was beautiful or not? She could have been an ugly hag and been Sarah Imenu. Does it make a difference she was pretty? Obviously the Torah felt it made a difference. I had to point out that Sarah Imenu was as pretty at 20 as she was at 7. The only problem is, speaking from the other side of the fence, it seems to me that a 20-year-old is prettier than a 7-year-old. So what does it mean she was as pretty at 20 as she was at 7? The answer is the beauty of a 20-year-old is very subjective, very culturally subjective. In certain societies, what's considered pretty is considered ugly in another society. I give you an example I always like to give. The Ubangi warriors, right, put saucers in their daughters' mouths between their gums and their lip to make their upper lip stick out. And as they grow, the saucer grows. And by the time they are teenagers, their upper lip sticks out about 6-7 inches, minimum. And if you don't have an upper lip that sticks out 6-7 inches, you'll never find the shidduch amongst the Ubangis. In America, if you have an upper lip that sticks out 6 or 7 inches, you are sent to the orthodontist and spend thousands of dollars to correct it because you'll never find the shidduch otherwise. Right? I had a daughter who had orthodonture, a need for orthodonture. I was seriously considering sending her to the Ubangis. It would have been much cheaper. In any case, so that kind of beauty is extremely culturally subjective. Yet
wasn't Esther green?
Esther was green, yes. She was not really green, she was olive colored. But she was, again, but it says by Esther, that Esther no se schein de'enei kol ro'eha. Esther found favor in the eyes of everyone who saw her. And the obvious question is, did she have an upper lip that stuck out 6 or 7 inches or not? Because for the Ubangi, she would have been beautiful, but the American, she would have been ugly. So how could she have found favor in everybody's eyes? The answer is, there is a certain kind of beauty that is universal, that's not culturally subjective, that's the expression of an inner innocence. That's the beauty of a 7-year-old. There's a certain innocence that is reflected externally. That kind of beauty is universal. That's the beauty that Sarah Imenu had. When she was 20, she had that beauty that everyone could appreciate. It was the inner beauty that she had that shone to the outside. That kind of chen, right? That's a certain kind of charm, or it's not a good word for chen. You know what chen is, right? It's a chen that has nothing to do with the external attributes of the person. It's something that expresses an inner innocence, an inner beauty.
Somebody said, if you're beautiful at 20, it's a gift from God. If you're beautiful at 70, it shows the life you live.
Okay, I'll go along with that. In any case, so that is beauty. The Yavanim turn beauty backwards. Yavan is noi, beauty, backwards, because they took beauty and relegated it only to the externals. And that is a distortion of what real beauty is. And therefore, the Greeks sought to make a world where the lifestyle of the world was totally external, where there was no such thing as any internal values. And the Jewish people were a thorn in their side. When they conquered other nations, so each one was an idol worshiper in a different way, had different customs, different folklore. That they could stand, as long as the values and the lifestyle was the same as theirs. It could be a different variation, but basically the same idea. By the Jews, they found that it wasn't just a variation of their lifestyle, it was a completely different lifestyle. There was an inner value which was more important than the externals. So they sought to make us conform, and that we should have the same lifestyle as them. We should have only an external, even if we have different customs, we have mitzvahs, that didn't bother them, as long as it's not something more than the external. So they targeted basically five things. Firstly, before these five things, they wanted us to get rid of Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebichsav, a written Torah, is basically a book of folklore like any other book. And you can interpret any way you want, and you can live a very nice external life and just have a Torah. The Goyim have the Old Testament, which happens to be our Torah, and doesn't make any impression on them. And they can take it as Bible stories or whatever and live an extremely external life just with an Old Testament. But once you add the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is the Mishnah, which is the same letters as Neshama, you add a soul to the Torah. It's a way of life. It tells you how to live. It becomes living. That's what the Torah Shebaal Peh does to the Torah Shebichsav. It adds a neshama to it. That they didn't want. There's no such thing as a neshama. There are no souls. There's only body. There's only materialism. That's what the Greeks represented. And therefore, they targeted five things. Those five things were Shabbos, because Shabbos represents the neshama of the physical world. The physical world was created in 6 days. On the seventh day, God added a spiritual dimension to this world. The 6 days represent this world. Shabbos is a hint to the world to come. The physical world has a neshama to it. There's a spiritual purpose to everything. And if you live according to that, then you prepare for the spiritual world, which is the next world. So this physical world is a means to reach the spiritual world. But Shabbos introduces that. Till Shabbos, there was 6 days of physical creation. So they wanted to do away with Shabbos. You can keep with your 6 days of created world, fine, but it's only a physical world. There's nothing beyond that. So Shabbos was something that they targeted. Then Bris Milah. The body is a physical plant. If there's no neshama, then it's just a bunch of chemicals, just a physical thing. Bris Milah represents the fact that the body has a connection to God. There's a bris, there's a covenant, there's a connection, there's a bond between the body and God. There's godliness in that body, which means there's a neshama. So Bris Milah represents the neshama of the body. Rosh Chodesh represents the inducement or the introduction of holiness into time. Time is also a body. It's a creation. A very cold thing that you can kill, you can waste, right? That's time. But time can be sanctified. How do we sanctify time? By declaring Rosh Chodesh and sanctifying the new moon, and then that gives holiness into time, that 15 days later is Sukkot, or 15 days later is Pesach, and there are holy days, holy times, times that are infused with holiness, but it all stems from the holiness that we put into time on Rosh Chodesh. So Rosh Chodesh represents the neshama of time, the spiritual value of time. They wanted to do away with that too. So Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Bris Milah, and then women. Why women? What were the gzeros against women? They made one decree that any woman who's getting married for the first time, before she can live with her husband, she has to have relations with the Greek general of that area, to totally reduce marriage to a very physical, external thing. And that her first experience should be with this goy and not with her husband. So to be a totally external, physical thing with no kedusha into it. So they wanted to take away the kedusha out of marriage. And married women, they didn't permit to go to the mikveh. They wanted to take the tahara, the purity of marriage, out of it. That was their two gzeros. Reason being that there is a significant difference between the Jewish approach to women and the secular approach to women, even today. Today, the Greek way of life has basically passed on to Western culture. Greece became Rome, Rome became the Holy Roman Empire, and from there spread out Western culture over Europe and to America. And a lot of the foundations of Greece still exist in the philosophy of Western culture. And women are viewed, for the most part, as objects, as on their external merits. And even though we live in a liberated refined, progressive world, right, where they still have Miss Universe, Miss America, Miss Israel pageants, they fool themselves into thinking that we have gone beyond the externals, because part of the contest is the women writing poetry and reading their poetry and discussing their careers, but it's all done in bathing suits, which has me believe that it's not the poetry or the careers that is the ikar. So it's still the same world. And from a Jewish standpoint, without going into great detail, women are the foundation of holiness by the Jewish people. And that's not just to make you feel good. It's true. I'll prove it to you. Because if you're not a convert, what is the only factor that determines whether you have a Jewish holy soul or a non-Jewish non-holy soul? What is the only factor? The mother, if your mother was Jewish. And up until today, most mothers were women. And therefore, may have changed, but up until today, that has been the case. And therefore, women are the foundation of holiness by the Jewish people. So by the non-Jew, by the secular world, I shouldn't say the non-Jew, because there are a lot of non-Jews in the world, but by the secular world, right, the view is totally external. And women are a pivot in that external world. And in the Torah world, the women are the inner kedusha of Klal Yisrael, is contained by women. Money, the same thing. From a secular standpoint, money is a value to itself. You don't have to use it. You just have to have it. The richer you are, and that makes you a bigger person, a better person, more influential person. I once met a cab driver in New York. I usually don't take cabs, to tell you the truth, because I have my own car. So I don't have to take cabs here in Eretz Yisrael. And when I'm in America, usually I'm on a budget that other people are paying for, and I feel a little guilty to go and take their money and use a cab. If I can walk, I walk. So, but I was once walking, it was a snowstorm, and I decided this is ridiculous, I'm going to take a cab. So I got into a cab, and the cab driver says to me, "You look Jewish." I said, "Yeah." And I said, and "You sound Israeli." He said, "Yeah." So we got right off. He said, "Where do you live?" I said, "I live in Israel. I'm just here." He says, "You live in Israel?" He said, "I'm from Israel. I came here. And you went there from here?" Couldn't believe it. Then I said, "Okay." He said to me, "Are you happy there?" I said, "Very." I said, "Are you happy here?" He said, "No." I said, "Why aren't you happy? Obviously, you came here to whatever reasons you had to leave Eretz Israel to come to America. Aren't you accomplishing what you wanted to accomplish?" He said, "Yeah, I came to make money, right? I'm driving a cab." I couldn't see that he was exactly a rich man, but okay. He said, "No, I'm okay. That's not why I'm not happy." He said, "In Israel, my friends," and he obviously was not a Shomer Mitzvah, at least not in our terms. So he said, "In Israel, my friends looked at me for what I was. Here, you're judged by how much money you have in your pocket. More money, then you're more important person. Less money, less important person. I can't take that. This is a secular Israeli. So that's the way the world is. Money, some people work for money. They kill themselves. They sacrifice their family. They sacrifice all their morals or whatever, and they don't even use the money. They have no time. They're working themselves to death. They just have it in the bank, and having it is important. From a Torah standpoint, money is also important. It said, Tzadikim, Mimonim, Chaviv Aleihem, Yosef Migufa. A tzaddik, his money is more precious to him than his body. That's a tzaddik. What does that mean? What it means is a tzaddik understands that his material possessions, his money, is given to him to serve God with it. It's a utensil for serving God, just like his body. Now you come into this world, you get a part to play. So you have your part, you have your mitzvahs, your character, whatever. That's you, that's your part. Then you get a costume, that's called your body. Then you get props. All these things are needed to fulfill your part in the world. So you need a costume, you need your props, and that's how you have your part in the play. So a tzaddik understands that his body and his material possessions are merely utensils to serve his part in this world. And it's the function that makes it important, not having it. It's using the money properly, right, that makes it important. Why is it more precious than his body? Because since both of them are utensils to serve God, right, that which a person puts more effort into is more precious to him. Your body, you didn't have to put any effort into acquiring it. It was given to you as a birthday present on your first birthday, right? When you were born, you were given a body. You have to put effort into maintaining the body and into using it. Money, since tzaddikim don't steal, they have to put effort into acquiring their money. Every penny is earned honestly. They have to put effort into maintaining it and to using it. So there's more effort in the money than in the body. It's more precious. Both of them are utensils to serve Hashem. And therefore, the Greeks made decrees against money because that was one of the pivots of where our lifestyle is different than theirs. To us, money was important because of its inner value, because of its function. And according to them, it was the external, just having the money, that made it important. So what did they make a decree? That no Jew could own any material thing. Money, a tape recorder, a book, a house, an ox, anything. Unless they engraved on it, we have no share in the God of Israel. They had it right on their money, on their material things, we have no share in the God of Israel. That this money has nothing to do with godliness. It's just money. Just an object. Finished. Those were the five things that the Greeks did. And therefore, the Rabbanu Shel Olam counteracted the Greeks by arousing the Kohanim, who are the inner spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, not the physical leaders, like the Melech. They're the spiritual leaders. They're the ones who fought against the Greeks, because that was the war was. Is the physical the main thing or the spiritual the main thing? And the miracle of Hanukkah is exactly that. It's not the physical that is the main thing. There doesn't have to be any conflict between the physical and the spiritual. They can work together very nicely. But when there is a conflict, it's the spiritual that's more significant than the physical. How do I know? Because what was the miracle of the war? We were weak, we were few, as opposed to the Greeks, who were many and strong. We were pure, they were defiled. We were righteous, they were wicked. We learned Torah, and they were scoffers. So it says that God put all the weak and the few and the pure and the righteous in the hand, the other ones in our hands. So I understand it's a miracle if the weak and the few win over the many and the strong. But where's the miracle that the righteous win over the wicked? There's some kind of unwritten natural law that righteous people always lose? That pure people always lose? Where's the miracle in that? The answer is that's not what it means. What it means is the following. We did not win because we were weak and few. We won despite the fact that we were weak and few. So why did we win? Because we had the spiritual edge. We were pure, righteous, and learned Torah. They didn't have that spiritual edge. They only had the physical edge. We didn't have the physical edge. So it was the physical edge against the spiritual edge, and we won. Obviously, the spiritual is more important. And that's the miracle of the oil, too. It doesn't make a difference how much oil. It's not how much. It's not how big. It's how pure. A little bit of pure oil goes a long way. And a lot of defiled oil goes nowhere. The main thing is the internals, not the externals. That is the lesson. That's the lesson of menorah. The menorah is a beautiful kli, the most beautiful golden kli in the mikdash. But its main purpose was that flame on the top of it, not the menorah itself. The menorah itself was only a means to be able to light a flame on it. That is the symbol of the menorah. Lo b'chayil v'lo b'koach. It's not with numbers nor with strength. Ki im baruchi omar Hashem. It's my spirit that's the main thing. That is the symbol of the menorah. That is the lesson of Hanukkah. The lesson of Hanukkah is there were a lot of nations. We sing Mal Sur standing by the candles. Right? We speak about all the empires that oppressed us. And we sing by and standing in front of the candles. What does it tell me? We're still around singing about these empires. They're not around anywhere singing about anybody. They disappeared into the history books. And they had everything physical, material, going for them. Everything. And we had none of that. But we had these candles. We're still here. They're not here. So what's more significant? What's the main thing? That's exactly the lesson of Hanukkah. Just to end on a light note, pun intended. When I first came to Israel, I was really upset to a certain degree. Because in Chutz La'aretz, the food of Hanukkah was latkes. And here, I cannot didn't see a latke publicly anywhere, only jelly donuts. And until the first year I was here, I was driving by an army base, and there was a gigantic sign that said latkes with an arrow pointing in. I said, well, at least the army still has, you know, some kind of tradition over here of having latkes. Then I realized it didn't say latkes, it said latekes. But it looked good. In any case, so I understand why we eat latkes, because they're fried in oil. You could probably put a wick in a latke and it'll last for 8 days. So it's really like the miracle. But jelly donuts, I understand if they just eat donuts, because donuts are also fried in oil. But why jelly donuts? The answer is that's exactly the lesson of Hanukkah. It's not what's on the outside that's the ikker. It's what's on the inside that's the ikker. Okay, I'll leave you with that.